If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. And Tim, we're kind of shaking things up. We had an opportunity to talk to an amazing pair of guests today. Amy Bruni, who was originally slated to be on the show today, is going to join us on November 12th to talk about her brand new book. It is Life with the Afterlife, 13 Truths I Learned About Ghosts. Amy Bruni is the host, of course, of Kindred Spirits on the Travel Channel. And I don't want to brag, Tim. It's a pretty great book, not just because I'm in it.
Oh.
But partly because I'm in it. But that's a great book. We're going to talk with Amy. She'll be our guest on November 12th. So make sure you tune in for that. Now, normally you guys would hear Parashare Supernatural News today. But being the fact that it's Halloween week, we're right here in the thick of the spooky nature. We wanted to revisit a favorite episode that we've done in the past and catch up with what has been happening with this case. We'll do that in just a few moments. First off, you've heard us talking about it. It is here, folks, coming up from Focus Features, the new movie Come Play, out in theaters Friday, October 30th. Tim and I get to see it tonight in a special at-home premiere, and we're really excited about this. It's based on the acclaimed short film Larry from Jacob Chase, and this is, Tim, you and I have seen the trailer. We've seen all the information on it. This looks like a great movie.
It really does. It looks quite creepy, Dave.
And it's got the aspects of, to me, it's got this feel of kind of revisiting some of my favorite horror movies. There's even like a little, and I'm not saying there's aliens involved. I don't know. I haven't seen it. But there's that kind of feel of Close Encounters and Poltergeist, and then even Paranormal Activity, and you've just got some of these really amazing elements. It's its own standalone feature. It's really creepy looking, and I love the fact that it's using technology, because Tim, I've had a lot of people that use those apps on their phones where they'll turn it on and the app recognizes a human face, so it puts bunny ears on you and a little nose, and then all of a sudden another face will pop in next to the people.
Yeah.
And it's only supposed to recognize human faces.
Yeah, you know, as one who uses Face ID a little bit too much on my iPhone, it kind of creeped me out to see that little facial recognition thing being used in the trailer. Yeah, I'm a little creeped out.
Yeah, so that is pretty cool. There's different aspects of this. For those of you that don't know about it, newcomer Azzy Robertson stars as Oliver, who's a lonely young boy who feels different from everyone else. He's desperate for a friend, and he seeks solace and refuge in his ever-present cell phone and tablet when a mysterious creature starts using Oliver's devices, and it's trying to break itself into the new world. It seems Oliver's not the only one looking for a friend, Tim. And this mother and father have to fight to save their son from this monster beyond the screen. The trailer, we have a link for it in today's program. Watch it. It is amazing. We will give you our review tomorrow. Fingers crossed, hoping it lives up to the hype. But just the commercial is creepy as hell and is going to give you some nightmares. So check out the trailer for that. And one other thing before we get to today's interview, Tim. Last week, when we were doing Supernatural News, and you and I were talking, and I can't remember if I mentioned it on air or off air, but I said, you know, with the disclosure, it kind of feels like the paranormal disclosure is upon us. More and more people are coming forward. And I said, you know, is the government maybe manipulating and utilizing people like Demi Lovato, Miley Cyrus, Khloe Kardashian, who are influencers? Whether anybody out there listening to our show likes them or not, they are influencers and they have a great reach.
Yeah.
All three in the same week came out talking about UFO experiences independently of one another.
Right.
You've got many other people, including Aaron Rodgers. And I said, listen, if the government is looking to break this, and I, like I said, I can't remember if I mentioned this on air or to you off air. If you remember, I mentioned to you, Tim, if the government's listening and they want somebody, we'll be happy to work with them. Just give us a sign you want us to work with them. Right? The next night, Tim, I'm preparing to do a radio show as a guest to talk about the Holzer Files return.
Okay.
And my wife's in the room with me. And my Echo turns on and it says September 11th, 2001. Then there's a pause. Then it says the Lincoln bedroom. Then it says some other mumbo jumbo. And the two of us look at each other and then it starts giving what sounds like coordinates and then goes off. And I look at my wife and I look at Echo and I go, Echo, repeat. I'm sorry. There's nothing to repeat.
Okay.
Nine eleven, right? Conspiracy. The Lincoln bedroom, known to be haunted. And I don't know that it was coordinates, but all of a sudden the string of numbers starts coming out. And no, folks, I didn't write it down. I wasn't expecting it.
You never do. No.
And but I kind of felt like, oh, what the hell was that all about? So is it something trying to communicate with me? Is it AI trying to mess with me to get into your head even more, Tim? I don't know, but that was weird. I'm going to keep my eyes peeled for other strange happenings. One other final strange happening. Remember, tomorrow night, October 29th, the debut. Season 2, The Holzer Files launches on the Travel Channel. So make sure you tune in and support your old buddies, Dave and Tim. Let's get into today's show, Tim.
Okay.
We have got two great guests joining us. They've been with us in the past discussing this case. But for a lot of our listeners who've come on in the last few years, or even more recently, they have not heard about this case, the Ghost Rider case. And joining us today is famed documentarian and paranormal investigator Bill Murphy and real-life experiencer John Huckert. Bill, welcome back to the show. Thank you for getting back together with us on this.
Hey, thank you for having me on, Dave. Appreciate it.
Now, you were the first to introduce us to this story, and maybe you could, just to catch listeners up, and then we'll talk to John in a few seconds. How did you become aware of the story, and can you give us a little bit of the origins as you understand them?
I first became aware of him through one of the networks contacted me and asked if I could track them down. They heard of the case previously because of the many decades that it has gone back. And so I was successful tracking them down. To be perfectly frank, they were a bit skittish of being approached by somebody else with a network tie. And I arranged a meeting, spoke to them, met them. We had a series of back and forth. Trust was established. And then I simply asked, I said, may I take a look at some of these original Polaroids? Sure. They gave me an address. I went to the an office and went upstairs into a loft where they had file cabinets filled with shoeboxes that had, I think I estimated about 1,700, you know, just under 2,000 Ghost Rider Polaroids. So Polaroids that had either these anomalous shapes or animal shapes or words written on them. So I was intrigued from the get-go from the sheer volume of the evidence. I asked the obvious question, where did the photos come from? And they said it's people that bring in their own cameras and their own film, and they take photos inside the house. Not all of them have Ghost Rider imaging on them, but some of them do. And that's the only request that the residents of the homeowners make, is that if you do get an image on the Polaroid, please leave it here because it belongs to the house. And so that's how they assembled this large collection.
I've got to ask, Bill, you're somebody that's worked behind the scenes in film industry. You understand special effects, you understand film, mm-hmm. and you have done extensive research into things like psychic photography. And I know you are not someone who is easily fooled or manipulated by digital or film media. You know what to look for. You know the triggers that would set you off to believe that these things had been faked. When you first saw these images, in all honesty, what was your perception of them?
Well, the image is embedded in a film. It's not like anything that's laid on top. It's there's no manipulation that I could see. The unexposed film, it's a chemical electrical process. There's batteries that are in the film cartridges, and so it opens the shutter, exposed to light. The emulsion reacts to light coming into the camera, and it, like all cameras, the image should be formed by what you're seeing in the atmosphere, even with your naked eye, if it's a camera that's not specialized, like full spectrum, say. So you don't see anything in the room, but as the film comes out and you wait the nearly 2 minutes for it to develop, that's when you see the images. And we could see no way that, you know, obviously to us, that it could be manipulated. And actually, a couple of years later, we put it to the test. We tried to manipulate the film a number of different ways, all to disastrous failure. We were not able to duplicate this. And there's a lot of people on the web that were saying, oh, this is just, they're using cotton that is stuck to plexiglass. And, you know, a lot of things that talk is cheap, but try to do it. And you can't replicate it.
Now, you actually came in with your own camera, your own film, so that you knew nobody was manipulating this. And tell me about the first couple of experiences for you then.
Well, we wanted then not just with cameras and film, Polaroids and film packs that I bought from eBay and from what was left over at nearby camera stores. And, you know, you can't go out and just like, oh, I'd like to order a pack of Ghost Rider film, please. You know, it's not like that. You just buy Polaroids and they're sealed. And we did it and didn't have success on a solo visit. We did have success with other instrumentation behaving oddly. And one of their pets, they had a dog there that would avoid the spot where most of the writing and imaging appears. Like the dog would sense something. It was either fearful or respectful of this particular area of the home. And you point the camera in that area, and that's what the majority of the images would manifest. So if animals have a sense that humans don't, or maybe ability to visualize light spectrums that we can't and cameras can't, then they were able to detect what was in these areas. So the animals reacted, instrumentation reacted. We tried to have a traditional paranormal investigation. It ends up falling back to less let's do what we know has yielded results, and that's using Polaroids. And eventually I came back, we dubbed it the Ghost Ride Experience, and over two nights, approximately 75 people, and they brought their own cameras and brought their own film, and we got words written on the cameras, and, you know, it'd take a picture, the film would come out, and it would kind of be passed around, and then people would go, look, look, there's something appearing on here. And other participants would identify with somebody else took a photo of. And it became a little bit difficult to know which camera the film came out of because of the air of excitement. So we started laying them out and identifying what we were seeing in there. And we got words that are easy to discern and shapes. And ultimately, a shadow person.
A shadow person.
Yeah, that came during the Ghost Rider experience. And the interesting thing about the shadow person is that the residents of the home reported this, but they've never been able to capture an image of it. So when we put everybody into a group shot, there was an extra body standing with us, and it was completely blackened. It was a shadow person standing there with us, like, oh, okay, group shot, slip right in. And when the film came out, we looked at it and we go, wow, look at this. This is completely humanoid in shape. And we couldn't see how a shadow of a single individual would stand out without somebody creating a shadow. There was no specific light source from a different angle. The flash came out of the camera, and there was a shadow person almost like just joining the group. It was very successful. On each night, we did it on a Friday and a Saturday, as close to the anniversary of Halloween as we possibly could. It was on October 26th and 27th. And we asked one question. And this is a result of a reading that Peter James gave. He felt that this home may have been built over either a family cemetery plot or maybe a public cemetery plot when the neighborhood was, you know, prior to widespread development. And he said, I just feel that there's a body buried here. And we didn't know about that, but we asked that question. Is there someone buried under this house? And we got I believe it was on the first night, the word here, H-E-R-E. So it was sort of like an answer, you know, not a complete sentence, not multiple words, but it was here. But on the second night, we asked the same question and it said, dig. So together, the same question yielded the answer on two different nights. Here, dig, when we asked, is there a body buried under the house?
All right. This seems like a good moment to introduce to the show John Hucker. John,
yes.
Holy Christmas. What an amazing story and so uniquely bizarre. Talk to us, if you would, about your experiences with this house. And when did you start to be aware of what was going on and that something was out of the ordinary?
Well, before I get to that, I'd like to mention that the shadow person that was captured on film. For years, people have seen them. I've seen them multiple times, and to suddenly capture a shadow person on film was just remarkable. And I didn't even know about it until, I don't know, it was a couple of days later. Bill, he was going over all the pictures and stuff. He goes, John, guess what we got on one of the pictures? And it's just amazing because it's literally a shadow in the middle of the room with everybody. It was really great to see because it's like it validated the fact that I've told people for years, and other people have seen them too, but I see them all the time. And here's one in a picture. And all these years, we've never gotten one picture of a shadow person. So, and, you know, there is something about the energy of a group it changes the dynamic of the house. And I don't know, there's recently I've been going through the pictures and bringing out the best ones, and I found all these pictures of people hugging. And it's interesting because some of the pictures of people hugging have like light, like exoplasmic, what did Peter James call them? Do you remember, Bill, what Peter would call them?
I thought he called it ectoplasmic formations.
Yeah, there's something. Oh, it's like something like spectral energy or something. I mean, but anyway, it was sort of surrounding everybody. There's been times when he said that he was weak, and so we do a group hug, and the next thing you know, he's back like a battery charging or something. I don't know. The whole thing started back in the early 90s, and I moved in around 1990, I guess. This was John Makowski's house, and he'd been here since about 86, I think, 85, 86. And he'd had a few experiences, but John is one of those people that runs and puts his head in the sand. He does not like to acknowledge them. And so he'd have people over, and people were saying, "Yeah, there's something going on in this house." He'd go, "No, there isn't." He would just like sort of, you know, blinders on. He just,
right.
And he's still somewhat that way. It's kind of funny. He's still, something will happen, he'll just sort of turn the TV up louder or something, you know. When I moved in, I sensed stuff right away. But, you know, because I've had prior experience with all that, and. And I said, one day we're going to get something. I'm going to prove to you. And then Christmas 91, my dad gave me a Polaroid camera. This is back east. And when I came back out here, it was March of 92. I was sitting in the middle of the living room. It's a very small house. It's more like a cabin, actually. And I was sitting in the middle of the dining room. And I just felt this overwhelming sense that something was going on. And so I picked up the camera and I took a picture, and there was nothing, absolutely nothing. So I thought, okay, that was stupid. So I go back to working on the project I was working on, and the bathroom door opens, which is right where I felt the thing the first time. It was like across the room. And so I got like really nervous, and I got up to take a picture, and I was shaking so much that I snapped a picture of the top of the television set. It was like it went off, and I'm like, okay, just calm down. Then I took a picture, and this thing appeared in the hallway, like at the doorway to the hallway, and it looks almost like a comic book ghost. It's like scary and yet funny, like it's trying to scare me, you know what I mean? And then I'm thinking, what is going on here? So I took one or two more and got some other weird things. Whatever that thing was, it was moving across the room. So when Makowski got home, I said, let me show you some stuff. And he's like, cool, how did you do this? I said, well, I just took pictures of the thing. So he goes, well, let me take a picture. So I stood in the place where we got the first picture. He took a picture of me, and this stuff started appearing, and then the bathroom door opened again. It just opens. Now, you have to realize the bathroom door is it's an old cabin, and it was an old wood plank door that scrapes across the floor. You can even see the scrape marks on the floor because it doesn't open easily. You have to go and kind of lift it up and kind of, you know, scrape it across the floor to get in. So when it opens all the way by itself, it's very noticeable. So as the ones developing of me and the door opens, I just grabbed the camera and snapped another one and got like my favorite shot I've ever seen. It's sort of like this Jesus-looking mummy-like light form hovering in the middle of the room. It's really quite amazing to look at.
Well, John, what is that like? I mean, explain this to me. To sense that there's something in the house, to hear things, but then to get photographic evidence – even as absurd as you said it was, kind of cartoony looking and strange. What is that initial moment like for each different entity or transfiguration of how they make themselves appear to you? How does that hit you?
Well, it evolved over the years. At the very beginning, at first it was like stunning and kind of like unbelievable. And then my first thought was, my dad gave me the camera, and my dad's a practical joker. So I thought he did something. And we kind of went with that for a couple of weeks. And, you know, Polaroid film's not cheap. So a couple of weeks later, we finally could afford another roll of film. I mean, that's how, you know, poor we were at the time. And we thought, well, you know, we bought this film. This isn't film that came from back east with the camera. And started getting it again. But then we got, it's a sequence. It's six shots in a row, and the thing's moving. It's moving. It starts off with the same, like, sort of scary-looking face thing, and then it starts coming towards you, and then the dog walks in, and you can see it dissipating. So we're like, okay, something's going on here. So for about, March, April, May, all the way up to June, we just kept getting Polaroid film when we could and just taking pictures, and we were getting weird, like, there's some female shapes that we subsequently think we know what spirit it is. But we were getting all kinds of weird things. And then we decided in June to invite some friends over and tell them what's going on, because it's so unbelievable, and yet it's incredible. So we bring some friends over, and we're saying, well, we have some stuff to show you, and it's kind of weird. And they're all, like, looking at him and kind of amazed, but kind of, like, not completely sure what to think of it. And then my friend Rick said, is he here now? And then somebody, I don't even know who it was, picked up the camera and took a picture. And I'm standing there, my friend Heidi's there, and John's sitting in the foreground. And he snaps a picture. And then there's this stuff that shows up. And then as we looked at it more and more, we realized that it was a word. And it said, yes. So it's like, are you here now? Yes. And everybody just, like, went into shock. It was like the weirdest, like, wait a minute. There's a difference between getting weird little, I always thought of ghosts as sort of like tapes that played over and over again, sort of residual effect, but with no consciousness. And then suddenly there's a word. Does that mean there's something that has true consciousness, not just, you know, essence? And so somebody says, well, what's your name? And he says, right. And, you know, are you a good ghost or a bad ghost? He says, friend. And we just took pictures until we ran out of film, and that started it. So for that whole summer, everybody felt like they were high all the time, because it felt like, what is going on? You know, like, it's sort of exhilarating. It's so amazing.
I can hear it. I can hear it in your voice right now. Yeah. I mean, all these years later, there's this nervous energy and excitement about you when you talk about this. Is it ever frightening, John?
Yeah, there's been times it's been really frightening, but it's not now. But it has been, because you start wondering, especially when, like, the sighting show came in, and then we met Peter James, and Peter James started coming over. And he was telling us about the dead body under the house and stuff. And I remember we used to have the best Halloween parties, because, you know, we were the local haunted house. And so people would come over to, you know, bring all their cameras. The reason we let people in the house was because they would bring film, and film was so expensive. So we just tell them, if you get a picture, it belongs to the house. But you can take all the pictures you want. But if you get something with anything on it that belongs to the house, and some pictures got out, but mostly people were pretty good about it. But Halloween, I remember one Halloween, we had like 150 people here, and this is a tiny place, so they're spilling out all over everywhere. And everybody's taking pictures, nothing. And then all of a sudden, this picture says, get out. Of course, that was quite startling until you really looked at the picture closely. And in the tiniest little letters in the corner, it said, I jest.
So it's toying with you.
Yeah, it was toying with us. And he has an amazing sense of humor. He toys with us a lot. But at this point, there's no sense of danger or anything like that. Early on, it was just sort of like this miraculous kind of life-changing thing. You had to reorient your whole thinking, right. You know.
Now, I know that after doing the first interviews with you, I procured a few Polaroid cameras, some film. I tried a couple of techniques to see if I could replicate it in a way. And again, not because I didn't trust you, but you understand the skepticism of what logically could be done. I couldn't get anything close to what you guys have and the true beauty of the images. And I'll tell you what, folks, if you go to darknessradio.com under our news section where we would normally put the news today, I'll have four or five of these pictures posted there so that you can see them, the ones that are online, and give people a chance to see how remarkable some of these images are and how, like you said, almost comical in a few senses with the way that these images make themselves known. Now, Bill, again, looking at this, I know you tried to debunk it. I know you tried to replicate it, and you were not successful. Am I correct in saying that?
You are correct. Yes.
And can I just mention one thing real quick?
Please.
When Bill was out here, they were out here, what, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days?
Five days.
And I remember... Yeah. They actually let us sort of hang out and participate, and it was the most fun I've ever had. And I remember at one point in the show, that Fact or Fake, the show that Bill did, it shows Bill sort of adjusting something on a giant sheet of plexiglass. In reality, it took four guys a half an hour to figure out how to get this giant sheet of plexiglass at the house. And I remember John Makowski looked at him and says, yeah, that's how we do it. Like, every time we get ready to take a picture, we bring in this giant sheet of plexiglass. And it was so funny because they're doing all this stuff to... Because we've done... two Polaroid cameras and taking pictures of each other at the same time. And sometimes we'll get the same thing, sometimes we'll get different things, but they're not mirror images of each other. They're like they're different but the same, almost as if they were whatever the process of getting manifesting the energy to appear, it's like a millisecond difference is going to make a difference in the way it looks. If I'm not sure if I explained that correctly,
right.
But it's like,
I understand.
Okay. So anyway, it was just, we had a great time with Bill here, and it was quite fascinating.
Now, out of curiosity, in doing these tests, Bill, would you ever, or John, would you ever set like Bill here in the room facing you with his Polaroid? You're on the other side of the room facing Bill with your Polaroid and take pictures. Would you get images between the two of you that would appear on that Polaroid film? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, as I said, we used to do that. I didn't do it with Bill. Bill never did that. I don't think so. Did we ever do that, Bill? I don't remember.
No, we didn't, but in the original tape documenting the whole process that you had done previously, that's what happened. You had a camera pointed at you, and you had a Polaroid pointed at a video camera.
Right.
And there was the image, the apparition appeared in between the two, so it was there. And there's more to that I would like to elaborate on, but I
Please.
Don't want to interrupt John if he's got a train of thought. Okay, so I'll just continue.
No, go ahead.
All right, so. Dave, you know how a lot of cynics and skeptics, and you know, and it's okay to have cynics and skeptics, not cynics because they won't accept any evidence at all, but a skeptic, they'll bring up questions that are sometimes valid questions, and so you want to explore them. And so it's been said by quite a few people, it's like you really can't do justice to an investigation in 5 days. It could take weeks, months, years. That's the beauty of like what you're doing with Holza files. You're going back, you're revisiting cases that have been documented, and you're seeing what results you're getting years later. And that's kind of like what we were doing. We were going back to a case, the Ghostwriter case, and seeing if we could get similar results. And a reexamination of the images themselves, in preparation of what we're going to tell you in just a few moments, we started looking at him closely. John and his family members, they were looking at him, and we've always maintained that when you look at the Ghost Rider images, they appear to be floating in a 3D space. Some of them look like they're like close to a lens of the camera, this cloud-like formation. And other ones look like they're in the rear of the room. Other ones look like they're in the middle of the room. Other formations look like they're attached to chakra points, if you're into metaphysical aspects of the paranormal. And so they're all over. And in looking closer at the photos and doing some rescans of them, John Huckard and his family members there, they started turning the Polaroids at different angles because they started to realize, hey, wait a second. You know, there's a clear message here, but look at this on the side that looks like it's sort of like going into like a side view. And they started rotating images, and then they started looking at mirror images. And then they came to the realization that these images aren't always just facing the lens. They're at all different angles and different words and different messages. So it's if they're swirling around the personalities that are living inside the room. When you take your photograph, you're just getting a snapshot of where these different ectoplasmic formations happen to be at that moment. Maybe if you waited another moment, another message would rotate in front of the person. We don't know. Because it only seems to work reliably on instant developing film, the old Polaroid, not the new formula. So that opened up a whole other aspect of the case, that it doesn't look 3D, it is 3D. These images are forwards, backwards, maybe upside down. They're all over. They're all over. That they're not trying to orient to the camera.
All right. Now that we've kind of reignited this case and introduced it to our audience, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and hear what's happened. I think, John, it's been about 8 years since we saw you on the Queen Mary and visited with you at our science exhibit deal that we did there, where you had many of the photographs. We'll come back, find out what's gone on in the last 8 years. How has this haunting changed, or has it? We'll talk about that and more. Stay tuned. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. The Ghost Rider returns right here on Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. Remember, come play. The brand new movie opens up October 30th. Tune in tomorrow for our review and a special giveaway that you can only hear on tomorrow's program. Tomorrow's program, I'm joined by Shane Pittman and Cindy Kaza of the Holzer Files as we discuss season one and season two. So I'm looking forward to sharing with you guys what's going on for the new year. Tim will be leading the discussion with us. That's tomorrow right here on Darkness Radio. Today, we're discussing The Ghost Rider Returns. This is a fascinating case, one that is truly needs to be seen to be believed. If you go to darknessradio.com, click on the news tab today where there would normally be news, we will have four or five of the pictures from this case so you can see them for yourself. And it is really startling to see them in person. Amazing pieces of paranormal activity. Now, John, I know Bill reached out to me. We were chit-chatting a little bit, and he said, Dave, I think we need to revisit this case. And you were kind enough to agree to come back. Bill, what instigated the need to re-examine or take a newer, fresher look at what's been going on?
Because it was almost doing a disservice to the paranormal community to limit the photos to just the 49 images that you can see in the Seeing Things booklet. So Joe Augustine is an author, and so he was there during those early years, and so he actually documented in writing what was occurring. And you don't really have that in the Seeing Things book. And Joe's book also covers other cases. So with so many photos left out and so many more details that there wasn't room for in another book that Joe Augustine had released, the decision was made that the public is entitled to see a lot of these other photographs. And the fact that the discovery was made that it doesn't look 3D, these really are, these are 3D manifestations, for lack of a better term, of this ectoplasmic material. So a couple things was done, and this is what I hinted at before the break. A new book is being released. It's not 49 photographs. It's 100 more, over 100 more. It's 151 of wow. The Ghost Rider Polaroids. And he's going to be including some standard photographs of, like, the back of the photographs where the writings were. Because on many of them, they'd ask a question and write the question on the back. And they'd write notes on the back. And other photographs of the house, so you can get a sense of context. And so those photographs are going to be included as well. So you're going to have over 180 images in there, as well as Joe Augustine's in-depth writing on it, which is really important so people will understand the importance and the immensity of the case. But the 3D aspect was really intriguing. I happen to be dabbling with 3D, and John and I have been talking about it back and forth for quite some months. And I established rapport with a professional gentleman that creates 3D images from 2D photographs. So what he did, he took some of the elements. And this is the only time this has ever been done with any of the Ghost Rider images. He took some of the elements and combined them together because there were important elements and important messages. And he created a lenticular. Are you familiar, or your?
Sure.
I'll just say what a lenticular image is for maybe some of the listeners that aren't familiar with that term. It's you take multiple images from slightly different angles. And then it's a ribbed plastic overlay. So as you rotate the image back and forth, you see the images move around. And then you get a real sense of what's happening, how these images are moving around in the room. So in the new book, with the abundance of new images, with all the more complete backstory and current story included by the author Joe Augustine, the new book is going to be released. And there's another surprise about that. And John, I think you should share what's going to happen with the first release of the limited signed edition of this. What's going to happen with that?
Well, we're going to, I guess, randomly pick someone from all the initial people who get the first edition, and we actually give them a Polaroid, an actual one with something on it.
Very cool.
So we thought that'd be exciting because we don't like sell them. We occasionally have let some out, and people have stolen a number of them, by the way. There's a bunch that we don't have anymore because they've been taken away, but we thought that would be, for someone who appreciates this and understands it or likes the story, it might be something worthwhile. But let me just say something real quick. The The original book we did right after Peter James died, and we did it as a tribute to Peter James. And it had 49 photographs in it. None of our names were even on it. Only Peter's name was on it, and it was done as a tribute to him. And then subsequently, there's a lot of interest in it and everything. And this one, when Joe was here, he stayed here for about 6 months or 8 months. I wasn't aware that he's writing down everything that's happening to him. So that was back in, I want to say 95 or 96. It was a very long time ago. And he started the book several times. And it starts off with his family back in Poland before he was even born, the first portion of the book. And it's his personal experiences all over. And then the last two-thirds of the book is the ghostwriter experience here. And when I was reading it, I was amazed because I didn't know he had some of those experiences. And so we, you know, culled through all the unbelievable amount of photographs, and we tried to pull the ones that made the most sense for the book. But the other thing we did was there's a section in the middle where we're trying to give the sense of what it's like to pick one up and look at it. So you see the back, you see the front, you'll see it rotated a certain amount of degrees, or you'll see the mirror image of it. And so you can see all the different things that are inside the way you would if you were actually holding one in your hand. And that's what we were trying to do, is give a sense of the experience here that we've all been through.
That's remarkable. Now, you know, in 8 years, how often does the spirit make its presence known? I mean, obviously you just can't keep knocking out Polaroid pictures every 10 minutes and try to communicate, but how often do you openly try to acknowledge your spirit?
Oh, several times a day. You don't have to, it acknowledges you. I mean, it's just here. And, it's like, it's different now. The whole, temperament of the house is different. And, like, you'll have to come over sometime, Dave, and you'll get, as soon as you walk in, you'll feel it.
Especially I'm happy to.
You'll go, oh my God, you could feel the difference in the air. I mean, and some people, you know, get into it right away. Other ones, you know, super skeptical people. It's funny how many of them have come over here feeling like, well, you know, I don't believe any of this. And I'm absolutely fine if you don't believe it. You don't have to believe it. You know, we're not out to prove anything to anybody. You experience what you experience. But it's funny when someone, like a heavy-duty skeptic comes in, and next thing you know, they're seeing stuff out of the corners of their eyes, and then they're like, keep the lights on and walk with me over here. I don't want to go by myself. And, you know, it's just, they start getting a sense of it. And not everybody does, but a great deal of people do. And being someone like yourself who's had a lot of experience, I'm sure you'll sense it right off the bat, I would think.
You know? This evidence, is it backed up by electronic voice phenomena? Do you get anything aside from just these wondrous images?
There have been a number, like we've invited in so many psychic organizations and paranormal groups and things, and they've gotten a number of them. Yeah, there's been all kinds of words spoken and bits and pieces of stuff. Some of it we actually have on video. In fact, they're working on a feature film about it right now for ABC is, which we hope will be out by the end of the year. But we have gotten that. I mean, anything you can get, it seems like will show up here at some point. So,
jeez. But this presence, is it? Do you believe it's one spirit or multiple spirits? Have you become kind of a clearinghouse for spirits because of that?
Peter James said that this is like Grand Central Station for spirits. He said there's seven full-time spirits, only one of them which is able to communicate in writing. Apparently some of the other things, light forms and stuff, are some of the other spirits, but the actual writing is only from one spirit that we can tell. But it comes in through the bathroom and then exits out through the fireplace. And it moves right across over where supposedly the dead body is. And the most amazing thing to me is, over all the years, we've had dozens and dozens of psychics and paranormal people and stuff. And either they go to the same book that says this is how you tell them where the vortex is and everything. They all say the same thing. Oh, it enters in here. They feel the heart of the house. Enters in here, goes out, and goes out through the chimney, or by the stove, actually. And they all say the same thing. So I'm like, either they all know each other and are secretly messing with us, or there's something to it, you know?
Well, I would love to. We will definitely, when it's safe to travel, safe to visit with you, I would love to come there. Now, listen, there are new versions of Polaroid cameras out, and you can get the film again. I know my daughters have Polaroid cameras and love to take these little snapshots. Are pictures still showing? Are you still getting writing and communication?
No, we are not. And we've had quite a few different Polaroid cameras in here. And, I mean, seriously, they've brought in, I don't know how many they make of them, but all different sizes and stuff. And we were trying to figure out why suddenly nothing, not even like ectoplasmic light forms or anything. And then we found out that back in 2008, I think it was, when they literally stopped Polaroid altogether, that when they recreated it, they changed the chemical makeup. And the chemical that is not in there is now illegal, so you can't even get it, which leads me to think whatever that chemical is, that has some kind of sensitivity to spirits. And I think if you're going to do an investigation, find out what that chemical is and how to get it legal again, and find out why it attracts the things on the film. That's the only thing I can figure, because everything, people still feel things all the time. There's communication all the time, but nothing on any of the Polaroids, not one thing. So
that is strange. Now, Bill, do you know what this chemical was or has been removed?
I don't, but ironically, just last night, I found a batch of the original Polaroid film. That it was actually 2009, John, is when they stopped making it.
Okay.
And I found a batch of it in a case that I was like, what do I have in this case, in this storage here? And I opened it up, and there was in there was an airtight bag, and I opened that up, and inside that was another box, and I opened that up, and there was unopened boxes of Polaroids. Yeah. Now the issue is, it's not the film. The film, if you keep it in a dark and cool environment, it tends to maintain fairly well. The issue is the two batteries that they put inside the cartridge. I would have to have a way to dig them out without damaging the cartridge and replacing them, because they discharge over the years, and then it doesn't have enough juice to properly expose the emulsion. The shutter seems to move slower. You get distortions in the image, and the flash doesn't work properly. So it's the power cells becomes the issue. But I still have the unopened original emulsion in the cartridges.
You know, I didn't mean to cut you off, but recently when they were working on this documentary, they also found some old film. But they got the new film, and they took out the pictures and used the new cartridges with the old film. Apparently, you can only get like 7 or 8 photographs in the new cartridge versus the old. But then when they took the pictures, all the chemical had dried out, and most of them were blank or had weird little bits of like orange stuff. There was nothing you could see because the chemicals themselves had dried out in the film. So I keep hoping that, I wish we could figure out exactly what the chemical makeup was, but they had to reinvent it from scratch and not using that chemical. So.
Yeah, and I've seen those brown splotches that you referred to, John, and I didn't know that was decay of the emulsion itself. I thought that actually it was the power cells, because when it was ejecting the film, the exposed film, it would come out really slow and sometimes get stuck halfway, and then you got to pull it out. So it seemed like, you know, what we did at your place, October 26th, 27th, all the way back in 2012, that may have been the last hurrah of film with power cells good enough to actually have successful images appear, Ghost Rider images appear.
How do those images, those original images hold up? I mean, I know I've got photographs from the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s that were done on Polaroids that have really kind of faded in quality and color. Did you do any kind of restorative or scanning process to maintain the purity of those original images?
Well, we had to scan them all in. And of course, nowadays they have Photoshop and stuff. So we basically just sort of tried to enhance the vibrancy of them a little bit. So brought up some of the dark areas. And I mean, they're basically the same. We didn't want to manipulate the image at all, other than try to give it that sense. Like there's a shot of Peter James, and it's so badly scratched. So there's some filter, and we took out some of the scratches, but it's the exact same shot, you know, so it gives a sense of what they used to look like.
And that's for the book, but to answer your question, Dave, which I think you were asking, the original Polaroids themselves, they have not really faded. I mean, John have kept them in a proper environment. They're not exposed to light. They're still, the contrast is good, the color is good on the original Polaroids taken decades ago. I haven't seen the decay of the ones that are maybe hanging on a wall somewhere or sitting in a drawer where people take them out often. I mean, I've got old Polaroids, like family Polaroids, that are taken out from time to time and passed around and we laugh, and those tend to kind of get faded. But the Ghost Rider images are the original ones. You know, they're kept framed. They have glass on top of them, and they're kept away from light and heat, and they're holding up fine.
That's great. I'm glad that they were preserved and that they continue to, be able to be seen and are clear. Now, I'm curious, John, you have that many people that come through that inject themselves into the story. Are they taking their own photographs, having their own experiences? Do you feel that any of that exposure brought in uninvited spiritual activity? And Ghost ever acknowledge that or tell you, knock it off, stop having all these people come here?
That's a really interesting question, because occasionally there will be sleep paralysis. Occasionally, a few people here have gotten that, and it's a little terrifying because you feel like there's something hovering right over you, holding you down, and you can't do anything. It's only happened half a dozen times over the years, but it feels evil, it feels negative, it feels dark, but for the most part, we've always got the sense that the more people, the better, because there's an energy that people create, and somehow it's like a battery charging up the house. And I think that's why I like that Halloween. I think the spirits were like getting their battery charged up, because when they start, they just go. I mean, sometimes you'll get 25 photographs in a row. They just and people be asking questions, and it's like a dialogue. Who was really great at that was Peter James. He would literally come in, and we'd invite over a bunch of people, and he would start talking to Wright and ask questions of him and everything. And the next thing you know, they're talking like a conversation. You ask a question, and he responds, and then you ask a question based on that, and he responds. And it was really quite remarkable to see. So.
Peter James had a unique way of interaction, like he was truly sensing who or what he was communicating with right there. And he wasn't fearful, and it wasn't causing him to have any recoil of fear. And it was working, and he was getting EVPs pretty consistently, almost like wherever Peter would go. And the Ghost Rider case is similar to other cases. If you look back into the spiritualist era, where keep it jovial, keep it kind of light, keep it kind of fun, and then you're going to get good responses. I'd say, John, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think just about every single one of these Polaroid images I've seen, the Ghost Rider images, have a positive message in one way or another.
Yeah, and they do,
And it could be a bit encoded. Sometimes it's almost encoded as well. Like you think about it, and it maybe that message is meant not for this moment. It's for what is happening, what is put into motion already, and you just have to recognize when that moment then becomes apparent. So
yeah, some of the things he said back in the 90s ended up coming true many decades later, two decades later. But also, one thing that used to be quite enjoyable and quite exhilarating is to have someone over and they're like, well, do I just ask a question out to the air? And I say, no, just you can just think it. You don't even need to ask it out loud. And if you're in touch and you're communicating and he's communicating, you'll get a response. And we've had people come over here and, you know, they just sort of think for a second, and then they take a picture, and then they burst out crying when they see the image because it specifically answered what their question was. And that's quite interesting to see. I mean, that's really emotional when you see that kind of communication going on. So,
with the shadow figure, do you believe that's your resident ghost, or was that something else making its presence known?
I think it's something else. I don't think it's right. I think it's, we've had people see, like, they look like flesh and blood people. I mean, they're full, I guess you call them apparitions or whatever, but there's a woman named Amelia that so many people have seen and still see. There's an old man who has one leg. There's a family. My son grew up in this house, and his very first word when he was about a year old, I guess, he was standing in the living room, he pointed into the vortex area, and he says, ghost. And I was like, what? And he goes, ghost. The thing is, yeah, we kept the Polaroids away from him. He didn't even see them until he was 16 years old. He had no idea, because I did not want to imprint upon him anything. I wanted him to have his own experiences. And he had people he would talk to, and I'd ask him, like, who are you talking to? He goes, well, there's a family standing there, but they're not saying anything. They're just smiling at me. So he had experiences, but we waited until he was mature enough to handle it before he even saw any of the Polaroids, any of the writings. He didn't know anything about it. So I feel good because now his experiences are all his. They're not imprinted from all of our experiences.
Now, John, correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't he the one, your son, the one that saw the, or stepson rather, the how the words were sometimes mirror imaged and at different angles? Was it him that discovered that when he was scanning them for the books?
I honestly don't remember. It might have been. It possibly was. Because okay. Sometimes so many things happen all at once, you forget the origin of them. It's like the photographs. There's so many of them. Like, in trying to get these things together for this book, I've found photographs I've never even seen before. I went to everybody who I thought would have them, and everybody had a little collection of their own, and they let us scan them in and stuff. But through the process of that is when we started noticing all the different layers to these things. And so we tried to show that.
Are there people that visit or people that are in the home that the spirits are very outwardly disapproving of?
Yes. Back before sightings even showed up, there was some mention of one of the people that was going to come out here, and I won't mention who it is because they're still around, and I think it'd be wrong to say. But the photograph said, please don't bring them here. I might disappear stochastically. And we're like, what the hell is stochastically, and what does that mean? But apparently it meant the ability to appear at will, or something like that. It's been a while since I even have revisited that photo. But the thing is that he was talking about one of the people that was on the sightings team. And sure enough, that person showed up, And after, I think it was a, they were out here for quite a lot of shoots. And this person showed up towards the end of the shoot, and he did a photograph. The last photograph we got in writing said, "All this is over now." And we didn't get anything for almost 2 years. So, and we get the ectoplasmic stuff, but no writing. So whatever it was, that the energy that person had disabled them in some way, so where Wright couldn't appear, couldn't talk to us. So we don't know what that's all about. We still don't know.
Did it ever become addictive? I mean, I don't know how I would stop. I'd be so deep in Dutch to the Polaroid company. How do you, when you're getting that kind of responses, you know, what's it like when all of a sudden that film isn't available and the spirit just decides to take a break?
Did you ever see the Spy Kid movie where the two of them are falling down a bottomless shaft?
Yes.
And they're like screaming and screaming and screaming. And then after like 10 minutes, they're like, okay, we're still falling. And then they just start talking. It's kind of like what happened was, I mean, you'd ask every question you can think of, and then you get down to like, well, what are the lottery numbers going to be, and who's going to win at the horse races, and you'd ask every question you can think of, and at some point you're like, I don't know what else to ask. You know what I mean? So it wore itself down, and so what the joy became having people come over who had their own questions and watching them experience it, and that was enjoyable for a while until. Then it got like too big. Like, we shouldn't have done all those shows because more people got found out. People would come out and sit out in front of the house and stare at us and stuff. And I don't know. But the thing is that it gets to a point where there's no more questions to ask. We've asked him to appear, and he kept saying, not ready. And then we started realizing, oh, we're not ready. He's ready. But apparently we aren't. We probably totally melt down or something. I don't know. But yeah, you feel like you could just do it forever, and then you kind of get to the point where I can't afford film anymore. I don't know what else to ask. But now I have a whole new set of questions I want to ask.
Oh, I bet. When you would ask these questions, were you ever asking, I mean, you said lottery numbers, things like that. Would they ever give them to you? And
no,
were any of them ever good? No.
Let me just say, he never tells you what to do. He will inspire you or give like advice, but he won't say you have to go do this now. He only did it like once, I believe. He told me to call my father, like now, and it yielded some really interesting results. So that's probably another whole story. But that's the only time he's ever said do something. He only is inspiring. He's not like he doesn't tell you to go out and kill somebody or. You know what I mean? Or you have to do this. It's never that.
Well, if they're indicating that the body is there on site, have you ever considered having a cadaver dog there to see if it can pick up a scent or doing LIDAR or ground penetrating radar to see if they can find a body?
Well, let me answer it there. I'll let Bill have it. But I've never considered the cadaver dog. I think it's a great idea. But Bill, you can go ahead and fill in what happened.
Well, we did come in with ground penetrating radar, and we got, first off, let me mention the complication of ground penetrating radar on that type of terrain. It's not flat terrain, and you have to move this larger than shoebox device that's cabled to a computer and a monitor, and you have to move it at a steady pace so you don't get false anomalies. And it was very difficult because the house being built on a steep hillside, you're sort of pushing it up, and it's dirt and chunky clay and pieces of sandstone. So you have all these obstacles, even though you try to smooth it first. However, there was still an anomalous image of something that was under there that would have been too deep to dig without removing the floorboards and going straight down. So we tried to dig sideways, but as we were digging, climbed under the house and we're digging sideways, we were using hand tools, and the nails from the floorboards were cutting the tops of our heads. And so we were kind of getting a bit tore it up under the house, and we realized it was just too tough of an environment. Now, with that being said, John and the residents at the house decided that they would deepen the living room, so knock out that back wall and open it up to gain some more interior square footage. And that is part of that vortex area. I mentioned earlier in the call that their dog, he wouldn't cross over the vortex. They put food in the middle, water in the middle, and he would jump over and look at it, but he would never approach it. And the same thing just on the other side of the wall. You'd put something there for him or throw a Frisbee because he loved Frisbee. He would stop short of that same vortex area. Well, when they went to expand the house, it was going to be expanded over the vortex area. So now we had an opportunity to dig deep. So we brought in a mini backhoe and dug deep. And what we discovered was a chunk of sandstone that was buried deep that had markings engraved in it, sort of like arrowhead markings pointing towards the house. So we don't know if those were early tombstone type of signifiers. You know, does this mean like, you know, this is a plot right here? We couldn't decipher them because they were very crude markings. I photographed them. I photographed the whole process. Matter of fact, we didn't even know exactly what the stone was made out of. And so we eventually drilled it and sawed it open to see what it consisted of. So in the process, the markings were destroyed, but that's okay because I have all the photos of them.
And well, you so know, we're good friends with a forensic geologist, Scott Walter, from the TV show America Unearthed. And mm-hmm. he might be able to, he's extremely proficient at identifying markings and what they might be, what they could read, and could even date it possibly for you. Would you be interested in sharing those with Scott to get his insights?
It's John's call. I mean, you know, I've got photos.
We're always open to research. The thing, I think the reason we stopped doing shows is because when we initially started doing them, it was like to help us do research. And then the shows ended up becoming was trying to figure out how to debunk it or not debunk it, or just because it was really cool and they just wanted to exploit it. And the reason we let Fact or Faked in is because one of the conditions was, can you get ground penetrating radar? And Bill said, yeah. So I'm like, okay, let's go for it, because we want to find out what is going on here. And yet at the same time, we don't want to just exploit it. You know what I mean? That's why we haven't done a book until now. We just did a picture book just for Peter. But this new book is, it really gets inside what went on back in the 90s and gives a sense of the feelings and that people went through. And so we've spent a very, very long time trying to give this sense. And the pictures tell a story, too. They're not just random pictures like in the first book. They actually have an order to them in which they were taken and how the thing progressed. But we'd be open to, any kind of thing that tells us more about what's going on here. We're certainly open to.
Now, I'm curious about one thing, and I know my listeners will tear me apart if I don't go back to it. Obviously, we're talking about animals and that your pets would be cautious around certain areas. So my question to you is this. Usually when an animal is cautious, that's because there's something to be aware of. How does that make you feel? I mean, obviously you felt you had created a friendship with this spirit, but your animals reacted more, I guess, afraid.
Yeah, and I mean, even to this day, the two dogs we have now are not the brightest dogs you've ever had, but they're big, tough dogs. And when they sit there and suddenly cower in the vortex and look up and start barking crazily, it looks like that scene in Poltergeist when the dog's looking up at the wall behind her in the bedroom. They do that sometimes, and it's like, what? What is going on? What are you freaking out about? The one dog that Bill was referring to would not get anywhere near the dead body area and would literally walk backwards in an arc around the area, or would take a running thing and leap over it. Would never, ever just walk through it like everything was normal, ever. So, I don't know. It's a little unsettling, but I also think, you know, the dog barks at the mailman and barks at anything that comes by, and their job is to protect and warn us when something's around. So it just lets me think, well, someone or something is moving through the house. Because you pick up a lot of stuff here. You pick up things like, I mean, I'm convinced that we're connected to the L.A. City morgue sometimes because things just come through. Sometimes you'll get, like, waves of feelings. It's really interesting and scary sometimes. That part's scary. I remember once I picked up this whole sense. I was, like, really almost hysterical because I felt like someone was being – I felt like I was being stabbed to death. And I'm like, what is going on? I'm, like, freaking out. And then it dissipated. And it turns out a couple of miles from here, a homeless guy was stabbed to death. Like, and just thinking, you know, his spirit came through this house. Almost everybody I know who's died, not everybody, but almost everybody has visited me at the house within a couple of weeks of them dying. Some at the moment they die. And that's been really, that's been sort of reaffirming to me. That's very, makes you feel good.
You said it makes you feel good that people who visit the house die?
No, what makes me feel good is, like, for example, when my aunt died, she'd been ill and everything, but she wasn't on her deathbed or anything, and all of a sudden, I'm, like, laying there, and I sit up, and I heard her say, Johnny? She always called me Johnny. Oh. People call me Johnny. And then I immediately wrote down the time, and sure enough, that's when, excuse me, that's when she was passing. So
thank you for that. Thanks for clarifying.
Yeah, right. I was going to say you invited me over. I don't know, John.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess I didn't make that clear. She was on the East Coast too.
What you mean is when they come to visit, they're close to passing already, or have already passed over, but they're visiting you that way.
Well, it's interesting. My niece committed suicide a few years ago, and she's never visited me. Like, I haven't heard her voice or anything. But I had a picture of my whole, like, sister's family. They had, like, pictures of little magnets that were on the refrigerator. And her magnet would fly off the refrigerator in the middle of the room, just her magnet. So I ended up, you know, putting them in a drawer. You'd open the drawer, and it would fly out across the room. No matter where you put the thing, it just sort of leaps on its own into the middle of the room. I feel like she's trying to communicate something. I now keep it on my desk because it keeps it from flying. You know, like if I put it in something, as soon as I open it, you literally see it fly out and fall into the middle of the room. And just hers, none of my other relatives. Even though my sister's dead as well. Hers is never. My sister did visit me, though. She said my name. They usually say my name, and that's how I know they're okay. It's really interesting.
That's
what I meant by
really
there's a
remarkable.
Lot of communication right. That still goes on. You know, so
now,
I think it's because of that vortex thing.
Now, let's talk about that. I mean, there's this energy. Bill, have you ever tried to measure? Is there any kind of measurable difference in different parts of their house, electromagnetic frequencies or
yes.
something?
Short answer is yes. I mean, you know, I brought all their traditional gear that's in any, you know, paranormal investigator's case. And I know that's, you know, it's always a debatable topic. You know, what are you actually measuring? Because since you don't know what a spirit or ghost really consists of, you know, physically, how can you truly measure it? But to answer your question directly, yeah, I brought some custom built and some ready-made gear to see if there was any anomalous EMF fields being generated just in that area with everything turned off. You know, there would be no false positives. And right in that vortex area, it was going off. I'd move it over a few feet, like outside of the area where the door would stop. I'd put it there. It wouldn't react. I'd slide it over where the water bowl they would put it to try to lure their pet in just to see, you know, if it's going to enter the area into the vortex, it would go off again. So it's right there. And the answer is we were measuring energy fields right there. The origin, never be able to truly be able to say what was causing it, but I didn't see anything under the house when I was under there that was, you know, any sort of wiring. And I looked overhead. There's no ballast for like fluorescent tubes, because those can set up EMF fields, set up EMF detectors. So, you know, I did my due diligence and I did my walkthrough first, and I examined everything. And it was setting off right there, right in the vortex.
I remember before I met Bill back in the 90s when we were having out, you know, like the Orange County Psychic Association or the Pasadena Paranormal, whatever. I mean, we would have groups out to just get their experiences here. And this one man had I think it's called a magnetometer or something like that. It's some type of thing that measures electromagnetic energy or whatever. And he would put it over that area that Bill's talking about, and it would just peg. And he's like, wow, something's really going on here. And I said, well, let me ask you, could it be like a raccoon or something? And he goes, no, it has to be like a metallic object or something. I said, well, could there be like a transformer under the house? He said, yeah, it would have to be the size of a locomotive to get these kind of readings. So then I start believing. I mean, I don't know what it is, what that measures exactly, but it picked it up on his machine, and it made me think obviously something's going on in that area. That Peter, of course, verified during his many, many, many visits. So.
It is one of the most remarkable and well-documented case of paranormal phenomena. So many people have seen it. So many people have witnessed it and experienced it. Do you get people that come in that have absolutely no contact or experience or sense anything at all?
Yeah, we do. And actually, believe it or not, there's lots of people we know that don't know about it. We don't just say, oh, guess what, we have a ghost. But we had a party a couple of years ago. It was after the Ghost Rider experience, and I was inviting in all the people that, you know, enjoyed being here for a Halloween party. It wasn't any kind of ghost hunting thing or anything. And I invited my next door neighbor, not realizing she knew nothing about it. So she was here wide-eyed the whole time, just like having like quite an experience. And she was like, that was the best party I've ever been to, because he got to talk to all these people who had experiences here. She had no idea. She lives across the street. I've known her for years. And that's sort of the way it is. We don't like ever introduce ourselves. Hi, my name's John. I have a ghost in my house. I mean, you know what I mean? It's nothing we feel the need to share, unless if someone has interest or finds out about it and they want to ask, we'll talk about it, you know, but the people come in who know nothing about it.
What about your neighbors? If I could ask real quickly, do other people around you have strange phenomena in their homes?
Well, I know when the sighting shows aired, their next door neighbor saw it and came over and said he had had a whole list of experiences happen to him in his backyard. Ghosty experiences, women dressed in white, all kinds of, I mean, I'm not describing it very well, because he would go into great detail about what he saw and what he witnessed. But he was right next door, so we had no idea. I do know the neighborhood has had I guess all neighborhoods have this, but there's just been a weird sense of violence all around where we live. There's been like a murder-suicide. There's somebody killed his parents, buried him in the basement. It's a little girl that was killed. There was violent things that happened right around our hill, like right where we are. But we seem to be the epicenter, and the epicenter is like the calm of the storm. It's very calm and peaceful here. So I don't know how that all adds up, unless this whole hill has some kind of weird paranormal activity or energy to it, I guess.
But yet you and your family seem pretty well protected. I mean, you know, with all the bad stuff that's happened around that area, your spirit seems to have been this almost angelic Dale Carnegie ghost you got. I mean, that's a pretty lucky draw.
That is such a great, I've never heard that said. I love that, the Dale Carnegie ghost, because it's almost like that. There's this whole sense of always being positive, and you know what I mean?
Right.
So, yeah, that's great. I love that, Dale Carnegie ghost. But, yeah, I don't know what it is. That's why I was saying we're sort of like the eye of the storm. Everything's calm and peaceful and great, and around us a lot of stuff has happened. It seems to be tapering off, and I don't know why. Maybe this eye of the storm is growing bigger and influencing the areas around it. But because we haven't had a good murder suicide in a couple of years now. That sounds weird to say.
That's good. Yeah.
It is good. Yeah. It is good. So.
What? And the Dave, if you don't mind me jumping in, the fact that they asked, you know, what do we call you? And the Paul Aurora revealed ghost writer. You know, and, you know, writer being W-R-I-T-E-R.
Right.
That gave it sort of like a, it was almost like a, like an, still having this non-threatening type of answer. You know, call me this, call me ghostwriter, you know. But when they asked the real name, it was right. It was W-R-I-G-H-T, which was, you know, just a coincidence that it'd be like Ghost Rider is actually right. And when we did again another examination of the Polaroid that has the actual name, what we believe is the actual name of Wright, another person discovered that it appears at sort of like at an angle, like I was mentioning before, some of these words are angles, and that wasn't discovered until years later, that it looks like it's Jake, perhaps, J-A-K-E, so there's like a first and last name. The occupants of the house, they ended up doing record searches, and there's two Wrights, W-R-I-G-H-T, that are associated with that plot. One was a former homeowner, and one was the land developer. And John, that's correct, right? The way I...
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah,
yes,
so...
that's correct. But the other thing is we've also always, for some reason, felt like Wright was a last name and his first name was John, because both of us are John, and we always thought that maybe he was saying his last name, because if he said John, we would think he was talking to us instead of about him. But that's speculation. We don't really know. So,
well, two rights don't make a wrong, so you're onto something.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, God, it is dad joke central here. And, you know, here's the other thing to consider. In the photographs, the writing's always in the sky, so you were getting ghostwriter in the sky.
Oh,
huh?
That's pretty
good. Oh, my gosh.
We're terrible and good at the same time. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, very weird stuff. This case, with all of that you've seen, Bill, in your exploration of the supernatural and paranormal elements, how do you stack this one up against any other case you've ever checked into? And man, you were one of the first to be out there in New Orleans after Katrina and investigating the world's largest ghost town. What is this one like for you?
Well, Katrina was overwhelmingly filled with grief. It just permeated everywhere. And because I had a film crew, I was approached by so many people with signs with their names and phone numbers. I'm still alive. Please call. You know, and it was that. And so it was heartbreaking because it was my hometown. It was decimated. I lost family members. We lost several houses. It was just it was a bad scene. And I didn't go there to make it a paranormal themed documentary, but the people that were approaching and saying, I'm still here, and they're talking about the relatives that they've lost, and they said, my relatives are following me. And I look, and there'd be nobody following them. And so it was a lot of like, they're still here. And so it ended up sort of morphing. I realized the direction really had to be true to what the experiencers were relaying, and that they felt that these the souls of their relatives were lingering there. They were suddenly taken away and they're still there. And then on top of that, then the survivors were trying to reach out to other family members because a lot of them were stuck there. I mean, roads were flooded. You couldn't get out. It was a tough time. So that case in its entirety has a different tone to it. In terms of cases after that, Ghost Rider, to me, has been the most intriguing because the very large amount of evidence, and it's not the only Polaroid-based paranormal case. So there's precedence for it. And so I looked at some of the other cases, but I never was able to actually like travel to Germany, for example, where there was a similar case, and then the United Kingdom had another case. And so I could only read about them, look at some images, but this one was right here in Los Angeles. So I was able to visit and, you know, not spook the homeowners that I'm just trying to, do a TV show, because it really wasn't about that. It was about interviewing them. And a couple of networks that I've done work for, I've spoken about this case, and it's a very emotional case. And that emotion, for the sake of the people who live in the home, some of those heavy emotional aspects, I believe, are going to be omitted for privacy reasons. So it's not like Ghost Town where, you know, you see a lot of that in there. You see a lot of just, you know, pure destruction of lives and property. This, where we just want to show the evidence. We want people to see. I shouldn't say we, because it's not my book. It's Joe Augustine's book and John's and the homeowner's photographs. But, you know, they want to present the evidence, let the viewer take it in, process it, and come to their own conclusions. But I can say with confidence, this case trumps really any other case. That's why I have stuck with it. I mean, there's other cases that I wanted to go back and revisit, and I have gone briefly looking for evidence at a couple of other cases, but this one has access, and so it's enabled me to go back and developed a really good friendship with all the residents of the house. So the trust there is something that I treasure.
Let me ask you then one quick question, Bill, before we wrap up, and then we'll go to John. But do you believe that this is a disincarnate soul, a spirit communicating? Or do you believe that this is somehow a projection of the people that live under that roof?
Well, you know, my position has been that projections are the most likely explanation for hauntings of all sorts. However, this particular case has other aspects to it that it's crossing over into like a physical realm, and I can't say for sure. I really can't say for sure. I did mention this to John. I made this suggestion. I made this suggestion to all of them, actually, and they don't necessarily agree. They say we don't believe it's us. It's the house. It's something here with the house. And then in digging deeper, literally, and you know, with these specifics I mentioned earlier, it does appear that there is something with that location, that plot of ground where that house is built, is where this occurs, because it doesn't travel with you to another location. It stays there. So it's location based. So is this the proof of the afterlife? Let the viewer look at it and read the messages and let them all come to their own conclusion. I'm now turning my opinion that this is a haunting a true haunting that is based at the house. I don't think it's a projection. I think the chemistry of the people that live there may be facilitating it, but I don't think it's originating with the residents.
Very cool. Bill, I always appreciate your insights on this. John, what do you want to leave our listeners with concerning your haunting and the story that you have kind of been the keeper of for so long?
Well, I reflecting on what Bill just said, there's something about, I recognize that, you know, like the Ted Serios case or the fact that people can project with their minds. And I considered that seriously, like, is this all of us, like, projecting our thoughts onto the film? And then I thought, well, even if it is, it's something that only happens in this house. So it still has to come back to the house. But when I pick up things that, like, people who are dying or died, I know that that's facilitated by the house. And it's something that I think any sensitive person can pick up, and the house kind of is like a giant amplifier. All I know is that for me, I lost my fear of death. My only fear is leaving the people that I love behind in a way that, like, I don't want to have to communicate with them through pictures or essence. But as far as dying, I mean, I don't know. There's some real positive things I think that can happen. So I don't, it's not like, it's like I got over that fear after this experience.
Well, that's good. That's a great takeaway from this, to get over that aspect of your fears, because that's been an aspect that's driven me for years, my fear of death. And I've only recently come to terms with that as well. So I appreciate that, you know, you found some solace in what other people might consider chaos and high strangeness. John, thank you for checking in. I'll put up links for the book and for Bill Murphy's website as well, so you can keep in touch. Listeners can find your works and keep up with you that way.
Just gentlemen, so you know, and today, this is the day the pre-sale is being launched. We waited for your show
excellent
to launch it. So today's the first day anybody can ever get this thing. So,
well, we've got the link up on today's program guide so people can find it, and we'll include that link on the news page. When you go to darknessradio.com, click on the news tab, you'll see some of the pictures that we've discussed on today's program, and you'll have a link to that book and to be some of the first to get that pre-order in. I'm sorry, Bill, what were you going to say?
I was just going to thank you and Tim for having us on the show. It's always a pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you. I agree. That's what I was going to say, too. Thank you so much for having us on.
Great to have you here. Happy, safe Halloween. Stay safe with this crazy 2020, and keep us in mind if more high strangeness kicks into effect there at the house. Would you do that? And I will take you up on that invitation to come visit sometime.
Sounds great.
All right. Thank you all. We will be back tomorrow with a very special episode of the program Darkness Radio. We'll be talking about season 2 of the Holzer Files, talking about some of our craziest paranormal experiences in season 1 in our personal lives, and giving you some insights into what you can experience for season 2, which kicks off tomorrow, October 29th, on the Travel Channel. So make sure that you DVR that, watch it live if you can, or watch it within 24 to 48 hours after you DVR it, so that it counts towards the ratings, so we have a nice long time on the air. Stay safe, everyone. We'll be back again tomorrow. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to Darkness Radio.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.